The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. We're here with Dr. Eugenie Scott, Executive Director of the National Center for Science Education, a not-for-profit membership organization of scientists, teachers, and others that works to improve the teaching of evolution and of science as a way of knowing. A former college professor, Dr. Scott is an internationally known expert on the creationism and evolution controversy and is the author of Evolution versus Creationism, An Introduction, and co-editor with Glenn Branch of Not in Our Classrooms, Why Intelligent Design is Wrong for Our Schools. Welcome back to the show, Jeannie.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Also with us is Steve Newton, Programs and Policy Director at the NCSE. Steve received a BA in History from UC Berkeley with an emphasis in modern German history and early 20th century pseudoscientific movements like eugenics and forced sterilization programs. Switching gears completely, he then completed his master's in geology from CSU Hayward with an emphasis in paleoclimatology. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Steve.
Hello there.
Now, although there is no real scientific debate about evolution, there is most definitely a political debate. Was there a time when evolution wasn't a part of the political dialogue in the U.S., or has it always been that way?
Well, not for over a century. Interestingly enough, the history of evolution in the United States is really quite fascinating and has certainly had its ups and downs. In the late 1800s, of course, there wasn't much of a public school system at that point. Evolution was taught in universities. It had been accepted by the academic community. Most of the college professors, scientists, and other professors of the time at the universities in the United States in the late 1800s were clergymen at the same time, and they all just quite all got on the boat for evolution. They thought evolution was just fine. It was the way God did it. It was, you know, no big deal to them. And partly because of the piety of a lot of these academics, evolution really wasn't a big deal in the United States. That tended to change a bit in the early 20th century, and partly in the second decade of the 20th century with the growth of the Protestant religious movement called fundamentalism, which was a rather different kind of Protestant Christian religion than had largely been practiced in previous decades. Christianity got a lot more conservative, by and large, and objections began to be raised against evolution for religious reasons, but also for moral and ethical reasons. It was felt to be encouraging nature red in tooth and claw and exploitation of workers and so forth and so on. So the history of evolution in North America has been very interesting indeed. It's really gone up and down a lot, and not always for very good reasons too.
Well, maybe can you talk about the trajectory? Now you started with the 1800s. So how has evolution been debated in the political sphere? What's the evolution of that really?
In the 1920s, it was something of a political lightning rod, largely because of the growth of the fundamentalism movement. But politicians started using evolution as an issue. But again, not in the way that it's been used since then, not in the way that it's been used recently. Back during the time of William Jennings Bryan, it was the progressives, or what would have been the progressives equivalent back in the 1920s, who were the anti-evolutionists because of the association of evolution with social Darwinism and laissez-faire capitalism and right. Exploitation of workers and child labor and all kinds of really bad things that were going on, which were erroneously laid at the feet of evolution, because supposedly this was, the idea of natural selection. Of course, it was embraced by the Andrew Carnegies of the day, and they really did feel that this justified, science was justifying the exploitation of the workers. So a lot of people objected strongly to evolution who would be considered moderates or leftists today.
Interesting.
This did change, though, by the with the various workings out of the anti-evolution movement. By after the Scopes trial, evolution kind of left the education curriculum, and because it wasn't being taught to kids, it stopped being a political issue as well. And it really didn't come back to either education or politics until the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. Now, in the 1970s, approximately, when evolution was coming back into the classroom and the creationist movement was gearing up to be big enough to influence politics and to try to get legislation passed in the late 70s, for example, that would require the teaching of this creation science idea if evolution were taught. That was also the late 70s and early 80s, the time of the rise of a political movement in the U.S. called the religious right, which was the intersection of religious conservatives and political conservatives, realizing we're talking about an intersection because not all religious conservatives are politically conservative. There's, you know, green Christians and left-wing Christians and social gospel Christians who are lefties. But there's also, it is not the case that all of the political conservatives are fundamentalist and conservative Christians. So, but where you get that intersection of religious conservatism and political conservatism, that's where you have the religious right. And during the 1980s, they were they had more political power than their numbers justified, which, of course, is sort of an interesting political development in itself. But where education comes in, and I think one of the things you're interested in this program, is that the religious right was really concerned about spreading its ideas to future generations. They really had a long-term perspective. It wasn't just about this next election. It wasn't just about political power in the here and now. It was, will our ideas be embraced in generations to come? And will this, you know, conservative Christian ideas really take center place in American culture, which was really the goal of this movement? And so to do that, they deliberately targeted schools, realizing that the public schools is where a lot of American get acculturated, so to speak, to Americanism, but also to the culture as whole. So the religious right began to target local school boards, which was a brilliant idea, totally legal, by the way, nothing wrong with this. But it was a very, very good strategy from their point of view, because that way they could have much more influence on what is taught in the schools, keep what they thought would be the bad stuff out, and put the good stuff in.
So now the debate is mainly taking place in state legislatures and school boards at this point.
Yes, but also you can't really overlook the anti-evolutionism that occurs at the individual teacher level and in the classroom level, which in many respects, although it's kind of out of the loop of politics, is certainly what we at NCSE see the most of. I mean, the majority of the calls that we get are from individual teachers or parents who have a problem with how evolution is being taught, or teachers who feel that they're being leaned upon by administrators or by parents or getting pushback from students. That's not the topic of our discussion tonight, I know, but just, you know, just so your listeners appreciate the
Absolutely.
Fact that we're only talking about a slice of this anti-evolution pie, so to speak.
Well, let me get this straight. Teaching creationism in schools was ruled unconstitutional, correct?
Correct.
So now the focus has shifted from trying to have creationism taught in schools to pushing intelligent design.
Actually, that's not true either.
Okay.
Because some of your listeners might be familiar with Kitzmiller versus Dover, which was a trial at the federal district court level that took place in 2005 over a school board policy in Dover, Pennsylvania, that would have required the teaching of intelligent design. And the court ruled very decidedly, there was no two ways about it, that intelligent design was just a variant of creationism. And since, as you pointed out, Desiree, creationism is unconstitutional to teach, so is intelligent design. But again, the history is, you know, the devil is in the details, an appropriate analogy for our topic today, of course. even before the Dover policy popped up in 2004, 2005, the leaders of the intelligent design movement, presciently, I guess, were looking down the line and figuring out, you know, there's just too many problems with this intelligent design phrase and with the kinds of things that have been said that have been created as part of the canon of intelligent design, so to speak. We'd better change our strategy, because if we ever are faced with a legal case deciding whether intelligent design is constitutional, probably what the judge is going to say, intelligent design? Who is the designer? And pretty soon the jig is going to be up, because the designer is God. And in the American educational system, you cannot advocate sectarian religion or any religion in the public schools. So that is why it's unconstitutional. So the leaders had kind of figured this out a couple of years before the Kitzmiller trial. A lot of people don't realize that the Discovery Institute, intelligent design creationists, really did not want the Dover trial at all. That was the last thing they wanted, was to have intelligent design be ruled constitutional or unconstitutional. They figured that they would get a lot further if what they promoted was not straight up creationism or straight up intelligent design. If they just were to reframe the issue a little bit. And instead of talking about something that required an agent, which kind of gets you to God pretty quickly, they decided that you should be teaching the evidence against evolution. So a teacher goes ahead and teaches evolution, and then she pulls out her handy little supplementary text, conveniently provided for you by the Discovery Institute, which gives you the evidence against evolution. And then the students can have this wonderful critical thinking exercise and thereby come to their own conclusions, weigh the evidence on both sides. And, of course, this is the sort of thing that just, you know, makes scientists' head hurt, because, there is no more evidence against evolution than there's evidence against spherical earthism, right? So basically, it's a way of sneaking creationism in without by filling the students' heads full of all kinds of misinformation about evolution, which would lead them, so goes the theory, and they're probably right, which would lead the students to conclude that, well, of course evolution didn't happen, therefore God went poof.
Right.
One thing about the evidence against evolution being presented in that way in the classroom is, on the science side, what's being presented in the classroom has been carefully vetted. We're not seeing cutting-edge, fringe research that's just new and exciting stuff that is being published in peer-reviewed journals. That's not what we're seeing in textbook material. What you find in a textbook has been part of science for quite a long time. And as a consequence of that, sometimes textbooks have a bit of old information. But this idea of, we're going to bring in this cutting-edge stuff, as they claim would be science, into the classroom really is cutting in line for the normal process. There is a process by which intelligent design proponents could, if they wanted, write up their data, submit it to peer-reviewed journals, get a history of literature saying this shows intelligent design in action, and then scientists could critique that. But they're essentially asking to be cut out of that process and just go straight to the front of the line, getting their material presented before students.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking with Eugenie Scott and Steve Newton from the National Center for Science Education. Today's topic is evolution and politics. Okay, well, one huge, and I would say structural, factor that allows the evolution issue to keep bubbling up is the way that education policy is set. Specifically, the emphasis on the state and even local control over education standards.
That's certainly a big factor here in the United States. We have, you know, a large number of sometimes very small school districts, and they retain a lot of local control. When you were saying policy, it was making me kind of think, well, there's not really a national policy per se on this. Everything's very much at a local level. And when we take that factor into account, that makes our job more difficult. Because if we put down a creationist proposal in one school district, well, there are thousands and thousands of others, probably within that same state, that could have this introduced at another time, and we have to go tamp down that fire too. So in a way, this really plays to the advantage of what Jeannie was talking about earlier,
right.
the attempts to get into the school boards at the local level and get a creationist member on the school board, this is something that is pretty deeply embedded within the political process at this point.
Yeah, and there's another component to these school board elections, at least in the United States, and that is that all school boards appear to be elected by minorities of the population, because the school board offices tend to be very far down the ballot. Very few people in the community are actually paying attention to who is running for these offices, what their positions are. And so by the time people get done checking off the national and state and maybe city governmental offices, they get down to the school board and they just say, oh, well, and, you know, either vote randomly or just don't vote at all and forget it. And so when analyses are done, it's something like, on a good day, rounding up with a stiff wind at your back, 10 or 15% of the eligible voters are actually bothering to vote for school boards. When you have a situation like that, it is very, very easy for a minority with very strongly held views to take over a school board pretty easily. And in many cases, these minorities are religious conservatives who perhaps go to one or two big conservative Christian churches. And if they all vote as a block, right, they can very easily get people elected.
Is it accurate to say that state and local school boards make most of the decisions about curriculum? Because that seems strange to me.
Absolutely. And with the stress on the local school boards more than the state school boards. The state school boards can set some sort of basic policy kinds of issues, and they may often have control over this over the purse strings, although state legislatures also have a role there in most states. But really, the kinds of decisions that matter most are, like Steve was saying, the are made at the local school board level, because this is where the decisions can be made and are made. We have a very decentralized education system here. It's quite different from most European countries and different from Canada, too. Mm-hmm.
Well, a place that we've seen a lot of arguing over evolution has been in Texas. Maybe tell us about that.
Steve can tell you a lot about Texas.
Yes. Well, Texas has, at the state level, a 15-member elected board. And we saw quite a number of the members of that board being... Well, one former member was actually very literally anti-public education, writing a book is to go so far as to say education was a tool of subversion. And she homeschooled all of her kids. And, you know, that's sort of amazing that someone who thought public education was a bad thing would be on the state school board. But that's exactly the kind of thing that we're seeing happen here. Many other members of the school board there, when the science standards were up for review in 2009, tried to push through some things which were just very, very slightly covered intelligent design, talking about the complexity of the cell being a problem for evolution to explain, and talking about the fossil record being a problem for evolution to explain. These are really just straight creationist talking points that they were trying to put through in the name of critical thinking. And one of the school members, board members there in Texas, would always say, "Shouldn't students be allowed to ask questions?" Well, you know, nothing in what was going on there was affecting whether a student can raise his or her hand in class. So it was a bit of a non sequitur, but that's the sort of approach that they were taking, which, hey, yeah, everybody would agree students should be allowed to ask questions. That, with that sort of framing, though, some rather creationist ideas were being thrust into the state school board.
And the state science education standards, which was the matter that we were dealing with. Steve was down there. I was down there part of the time. We were working with our allies in Texas, the Texas Freedom Network and Texas Citizens for Science primarily, and a number of academics and scientists and parents. It was a great team that we were privileged to work with a couple of years ago. And they were trying to determine what components about evolution should go into the state science education standards. And a set of standards had been written by a team of expert teachers and scientists, and the standards were pretty darn decent. And then the board got their hands on them. And that became quite a struggle, because, you know, the board is the 500-pound gorilla here. They can decide to vote in any fool thing they want. So part of the task of us and our allies was to try to persuade the more moderate board members to vote against the changes that the creationist board members wanted to put in. I mean, it was, Desiree, it was politics of the clearest sort.
I'm gritting my teeth, honestly.
And Texas politics are not for the faint-hearted, believe me.
We have a question from Julie.
Evolution seems to be a political issue primarily in relation to education. Does it come up in other policy debates?
Gosh, I'm not really thinking of one. Are you thinking of one, Jean?
That's an interesting question. Yeah. I can't think of any circumstance where it would, mostly because the issue for the religious right is protecting children against ideas that would cause them to give up their faith, which is why they focus so strongly on education, because they worry about ideas coming into the public school system that will lead children astray. You know, too much secularism. Right. They worry about atheism, which is not a big problem in K-12, believe me. And, of course, evolution. And so it's pretty much education where evolution is going to become contentious. I can't think foreign policy. No, it's not right. I don't think it's going to have anything to do with it. The economic system. Not really. Although there's an awful lot of loose talk about natural selection on Wall Street, but I don't think it's.
Yes. One thing I might add is many of these so-called academic freedom bills that are introduced that are essentially anti-evolution bills. We see these at the state legislature. They often include a list of things besides evolution. They talk about evolution, but they also talk about, for instance, climate change, global warming, and stem cells, human cloning, that sort of thing. So there are other aspects in which evolution gets dragged into other science fights.
And actually, evolution was recently brought up on the U.S. national political stage. Why is evolution being discussed in political debates? What's the objective? Because as we spoke about, teaching creationism in public schools is unconstitutional, and probably teaching intelligent design would be ruled that way as well.
Mm-hmm. And I might add that the federal government, the national candidates, don't have anything to say about curriculum matters.
Right. So what's the objective then? Is it just for show at this point?
Sure. I mean, I think it fits in with the idea of playing to a particular voting bloc, playing to a particular set of people who hold similar beliefs, and evolution fits in with part of that, but the actual office they're shooting for is not really going to have much to say about that nationally.
Yeah, I think Steve's right. It's kind of a marker,
right,
for a certain component of the voting population, and because it's correlated with a number of other conservative religious views. Although it's not a one-to-one relationship, certainly, but it's an easy marker for you notice that it's never brought up by the candidates.
Oh, I know.
It's only brought up by the press.
Right.
Because I think it's just a sort of a convenient way of putting a little check mark between, right. Okay, we know where this guy is.
Yeah, and even, the former President Bush, really, despite all the social conservative backing he had, did not make much mention of intelligent design at all. I believe he discussed it once in his presidency.
Interesting.
So even for someone like that, this is not a big deal at that stage.
And we have a question. This is from Les.
I was wondering, is there any statistics that show the number of politicians who accept evolution versus those who believe woo-woo, like creationism?
Not on the national level that I know of. Many, many years ago, a friend of ours in Ohio did a survey of Ohio politicians and found that they actually had a higher than public average acceptance of evolution. But then, since the public average is about 50%, that's not that's not great. But they're 60-65% or something. Probably the correlation here is with education. because survey after survey has shown that the more education you have, the more likely you are to accept evolution. And politicians, for whatever shortcomings we might assign to them, they tend to be well-educated. They tend to all be college graduates, right. And many of them have graduate degrees, law degrees, you know, whatever.
I was doing some reading, and let me just read this out loud to you. It's from something called The Politics of Evolution, which, as far as I can tell, appears to be a pro-intelligent design website. So, this is what they say. The theory of evolution is a political wedge for establishing precedent concerning the federal government's role in establishing a nationwide educational curriculum. If a legal precedent is set that the federal government can mandate what can be taught about the theory of evolution in public science classrooms all across America, then courts can use that precedent to enforce other things being taught in the science classroom. These other things might include the government-approved positions on global warming and environmental responsibility. Once the government has established the right to require the teaching of these things in physical science classes, it is a small step to mandate the teaching of social science issues, including attitudes towards race, gender, abortion, socialized medicine, religious tolerance, the right to die, etc. So, thoughts?
Wow.
Somebody better tell the first President Bush, because he was the one who started the program that ended up in the establishment of national standards for mathematics, for history, for science, for literature. The idea of national standards was not to impose a evolution upon the educational system, but to try to make some kind of coherence and sense out of 50 different states and 15,000 separate school districts, each of which was going on its own merry way. And the way that this was developed back in the Bush 1 era was to try to make us competitive again, because, you know, Germany, Japan, China, India, all of these countries, which, by the way, do have national curricula as opposed to just advisory national standards, which is as close as we get, they were, you know, they're cleaning our clocks in terms of graduating more engineers and scientists and really taking the lead in technological innovation. So President Bush 1 set forth the programs, which were later embraced by Clinton and Bush 2 and on to the present, to try to set up advisory national standards for the major academic disciplines. And these would be these would influence, they felt and hoped, the states to come up with their own standards, which would then try to at least homogenize education somewhat within a state. It is only after 20 years of experimentation with state standards that finally we're getting some sort of movement toward national standards. But again, they're still voluntary. You know, we still have this really, really decentralized education system. And there are now national standards in mathematics that, what is it, Steve, 48 states have signed up on?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, something like that.
Texas and Alaska maybe being the exceptions.
Yes, guess who didn't sign up? But so what this means is that those states have voluntarily agreed to adopt the advisory national standards in their own states so that there's some sort of continuity from class to class and grade to grade within the nation. Now, currently, there are national standards being worked on for science, and there's, I think, 23... If I'm wrong on that, correct me, Steve, but there's a handful of states that have pledged to adopt the national standards. Now, sneak peek, guess what? The national standards, because they're written by professional scientists and teachers, are going to include the consensus view of science.
Right.
Duh! Big surprise here. And that includes evolution, that includes global warming, that includes some things that the religious right is not going to be too happy about. But this is not a plot to try to take over the schools to promote a secular agenda. This is, if anything, a plot to try to get the United States off its fanny and make it economically and technologically competitive again.
And if I might add in to reiterate the point, Desiree, that you started with, evolution is not controversial among scientists.
Right.
There is social controversy. So this idea of, as you know, Texas and other states want to kind of revisit the science of evolution, give it another critical look, is sort of like, in the context of our competition with places such as India, which have very good math education, saying we want to revisit and take a second look at whether or not the quadratic equation works. and to sort of be arguing about how we're going to do something when, in fact, we're in a very tight economic race, and as Tom Friedman would say, a very flat world, competitive-wise for economics. And this is directly hurting us economically in that way.
The biggest problem that we have in the U.S. right now, I think, in terms of technological innovation and competition, is that we have depended for 15, 20 years, minimally, on a brain drain from countries around the world who send their best and brightest here to be educated. And then these people stay on and staff our laboratories. They are our postdoc backbone of technological innovation. But we have benefited hugely from this. Thank God for these young people. I mean, they've really helped us maintain the cutting edge that we've had in this country. But, you know, things are getting a lot better in India now, and things are getting right. a lot better in China now. There's no reason for these young people to stay here. They're going to go back home and make those new biotech companies prosper in their native countries, which, unless the United States gets its act together and starts educating its citizenry in a modern 21st century manner, instead of politicizing it like happens in so many school districts and states around this country, we're not going to have that pipeline to replace these bright and hardworking foreign students that we've been so dependent on.
We have a question from David.
Every time ID advocates lose a legal battle over curricula, the strategy gets broader. Now the teach the controversy position seems to encompass not just evolution, but climate change and any other area of science that's politically controversial as well. Is there any chance that we've weakened acceptance for science as a whole by taking a stand on evolution?
Well, I don't know what other stance we could take. I mean, we can't ignore what the science says out of some other concern. I mean, the science is the science.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not like if we sacrifice evolution, that go away.
Right, then everything will be all right.
That's not gonna stop them. They still are gonna bitch and moan about global warming and stem cells and human cloning and origin of life, and you know they have this whole laundry list of topics that they want to have treated differently in the curriculum. Interestingly enough, although this isn't a topic that NCSE deals with, the fact that we deal with science teachers so much means that it's, you know, we science teachers tell us about it. They don't want to have both sides taught when it comes to human reproduction. They only want abstinence taught. They don't want any kind of broad view and let the students decide.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking with Steve Newton and Eugenie Scott from the National Center for Science Education. We're discussing how evolution is used as a political football. And we'll be right back with more of that after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I'm talking today with two of the staff of the National Center for Science Education, a not-for-profit membership organization of scientists, teachers, and others that work to defend and improve the teaching of evolution and of science as a whole. My guests are Steve Newton, Programs and Policy Director, and Dr. Eugenie Scott, Executive Director. So we've been talking a lot about U.S. politics. Now, does the NCSE keep an eye on evolution-related developments in other countries?
Oh, sure. We'll help anybody.
Thank you.
Well, we've been particularly keeping our eye on Bill 44 in Canada, which was this bill allowing an opt-out for evolution and other items. And we find this opting out of evolution strategy employed very much here in the United States. And so we were rather curious to see Bill 44 go through in Canada.
That was in 2009 that legislation was passed. And for those of you who haven't heard of it, that gave parents the option of pulling their children out of class when lessons on sex or religion or sexual orientation were being taught. But there was such an uproar about the potential to affect evolution education that the provincial minister responsible for human rights at the time, I believe, had to clarify specifically that the bill would not give parents the right to pull their children out of science classes when evolution was being discussed. And I actually have a quote from him. He said, "Evolution is not part of religious studies. It's part of science curriculum, and there is nothing that will change that going forward." So that's nice.
Oh, that's nice.
If only we had it so clear here.
Steve, didn't your heart just go pitter-patter at the very thought?
Well, an actual separation of church and state, amazing.
And we don't even have that officially.
What an enlightened guy, you know? Why can't we have superintendents of education that are that squared away?
Well, I'm thinking, though, that was specifically because of the uproar. And that's what I find so interesting is, you know, Canadians often feel like we're above all this. And when we get responses like that, it just sort of furthers that idea. But I was reading the NCSE website, and there was a piece by Brian Alters. He wrote about the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada, and that's one of the three major Canadian federal funding agencies for academic research. Now, they declined to fund a study that would measure the extent to which the, at that time, recent large-scale popularization of the intelligent design was detrimentally affecting Canadians. And that was around the time of the Dover trial, so Canadian media were covering that pretty extensively. And their response was, now, see, I made you happy, and now I'm going to make you sad again. I'm sorry. Their response was, "The proposal did not adequately substantiate the premise that the popularizing of intelligent design theory had detrimental effects on Canadian students, teachers, parents, and policymakers. Nor did the committee consider that there was adequate justification for the assumption in the proposal that the theory of evolution and not intelligent design theory was correct."
Yeah, that was the part that just sent Brian just screeching to a halt and, you know, just drove him in. What?
And that's the thing. Don't be so smug, Canadians. We got it here, too.
Yep, I'm afraid so.
So what are the potential repercussions there? What does a statement like that mean coming from one of the largest science funding bodies in Canada?
I don't think either Brian or anybody else knows how entrenched that point of view is, but it certainly indicates that the people who are on the committee that reviewed his proposal were not sufficiently broadly educated in science. The people who reviewed that proposal were all from the social sciences or humanities, and somehow they'd sort of missed the whole point that evolution is really basic to several fields of science. It's not just something that's an opinion. There's a real tendency in North America, not just the U.S., but really U.S. and Canada, to have your default position be fairness,
right?
Which, you know, overall is a good thing. I mean, I really like the fact that our two countries think so highly of individual opinion and allow for people's opinions to be expressed. I mean, look what's going on in China, for crying out loud, and in many other parts of the world where people are not allowed to speak freely or hold the kinds of opinions and act on them like we do. But there's a big difference between opinions and something that is a consensus view within science. I mean, you may hold, the opinion that the planets circulate around the Earth as opposed to the Earth and the other planets circulating around the Sun, but you'd have a tough time defending that as a scientific idea. And so if you're talking about, which often is the case because it's a narrow issue, if you're talking about what do you teach in a high school science class, you have to make that decision based not upon the opinions of the voters in the community, but on the considered conclusions of the scientists and teachers who will be responsible for that education.
Now, I've just been passed a question by Brent, our production assistant.
Why does Canada not have the same difficulties with evolution education that the U.S. has?
Partly because you have a more centralized education system. And the provincial government makes the decision as to what is taught, and that's what happens. And if a school district deviates from that, then the provincial education minister will smack them around, and it'll stop. So, but don't think that Canada is totally free of anti-evolutionism. I hear through Brian Alters, who is a professor of education, was a professor of education at McGill, and through some other contacts we have in Canada, that it is not at all uncommon for teachers in the prairie provinces, as well as in BC, where you do have a fairly large percentage of conservative Christians, those teachers do face problems teaching evolution. And there is pushback from parents and from students, and teachers feel uncomfortable teaching evolution, even though it's part of the curriculum. And, as isn't the case in the United States, it's very easy to just not get around to teaching the things that are controversial, even if they are required.
So I'm going to ask one more question, and then I will let you go because we are completely out of time, but I love talking to you both. What should we be watching for in Canada? Basically to ensure that we don't see the same kinds of things that happen in your country happen in ours. I'm totally being selfish here.
Well, I think because you have a pretty squared away top-down system of determination of the curriculum, you have fewer things to worry about than we do in terms of the passage of legislation or regulations that would compromise the teaching of evolution. That said, the American creationist movement is a quintessential grassroots movement, and that is where you will find it having its most success in Canada as well. And even though right now the probability isn't very high that Canadian creationists are going to get a lot of traction among the decision makers at the provincial level, this is a long-term strategy. And by weakening the authority of science, so to speak, weakening the confidence that members of the public might have about the strength of evolution as a scientific explanation, it's not impossible in the future that enough of a population might evolve, shall we say, that would start requesting those kinds of evolution compromising changes at the provincial level of their elected officials. So I think what you want to do if you are Canadian and you are really concerned about science education, support your local teachers. Make sure that your local teachers know that you want and expect evolution to be taught in your local schools, and that you will stand by any teachers who feel pressured from either other parents or, God forbid, from administrators, because it sometimes does happen, to either denigrate evolution or teach the evidence against evolution, or bring in some other approach that that is bad for your kid's science education.
The trends we're seeing, it used to be very obvious when the creationists were coming to town. There would be biblical quotes and such and what they were saying. And after a series of court decisions that were not favorable to them, it's more of a stealth thing now. So creationism might be coming to Canada And you won't even recognize it at first, because it'll be talking about problems with evolution, with complexity of the cell as being a problem for evolution, that sort of thing. So I would be on the lookout for these other forms that creationists may take that won't be overtly religious.
Thanks very much to both of you for being here.
Thank you.
Well, it's a privilege to be asked. Thank you.
You can find Eugenie Scott and Steve Newton and all the brilliant work they do at the National Center for Science Education at ncse.com. We've also linked to it on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. Before we move on to the next part of the show, I wanted to take a minute to tell you about one of our regular listeners who's about to undertake a wonderful adventure in the name of charity. His name is Gold. He lives in Wellington, New Zealand, but he's originally from Christchurch, which you might recognize as the community at the epicenter of the earthquake back in February. To raise money for several organizations that helped out with relief efforts, Gold is planning to walk Te Erorora, a 3,000-kilometer trail that runs the entire length of the country. He's looking for sponsors, and we're hoping that you can help him out. For more information and to find out how to donate, you can visit his project website at intentionallyhomeless.org. Good luck, Gold. And we'll be right back with biological anthropologist Greg Leiden to talk about the aftermath of ClimateGate after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're featuring a panel discussion on the origins and influence of tradition with biological anthropologist Greg Leiden, science education researcher Marie-Claire Shanahan, ethnomusicologist Kyra Grant Palmer, and primatologist Eric Michael Johnson. We'll discuss where traditions come from, why some endure and some fade, and whether they appear in non-human cultures. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Now, since I've come to the point where I am almost incapable of talking about anti-evolutionists without thinking about all the parallels with climate change denialists, I'm speaking to our dear friend and semi-regular guest, Greg Leiden. He's a biological anthropologist and author of Greg Leiden's blog. Hello, sir.
Hi, good to see you.
So you've been following the climate change debate, I would say, far more closely than any other anthropologist that I'm aware of. Why is that?
I think it's because I've been interested in climate change because of my research in anthropology since when I thought the big problem was going to be an ice age and not global warming, which goes back a ways. So I'm just interested in it. And also, science denialism takes many forms, and this is just another example of science denialism. It's very parallel to, in some ways, the creationist arguments.
Now, one of the biggest controversies around this topic was the so-called ClimateGate emails. Mm-hmm. Now, if you could tell us about that from the perspective of the media.
Yeah, the story in the papers was a group of emails from a research group were stolen and sifted through looking for the Piltdown man fossil of climate change research. And the main thing that came out of it was an accusation that a conspiracy had developed to, as they put it, to use, quote, Mike's nature trick to hide the decline in the data. So there was a trick that was going to be used to change the data that were showing a decrease in temperature globally to make it look like an increase in temperature, to hide the decline. And that was what it was presented as. In reality, the phrase, use Mike's nature trick to hide the decline, is a sentence made up from two completely different parts of this email discussion. These are people speaking casually to each other off the record, and Mike is a scientist who had figured out how to make some quirky mathematical thing work instead of not work. In other words, it was a kludge to make something function. So it was not a trick in that we're tricking you into believing something. It's just this thing's broken and we're going to tweak it this way.
Right.
And it had nothing to do with the decline issue. The decline issue is much more interesting. This is from tree ring data. Now, tree ring data gives you basically a tree grows at a greater or lesser rate depending upon various factors. And one of those factors is variation in moisture. And that can correlate to temperature. If you've got a system you understand really well, you can link growth variation due to moisture to temperature. However, many trees are not good at giving tree ring indications. The tree rings don't vary very much. And especially, for example, when a forest matures and all the trees are old, they stop varying a lot, partly because they're just so big. The amount of growth each year is very small. relative to the thickness of the ring. So you just can't measure it. And also because the forests get their own ecosystems going and the moisture doesn't change that much and so on and so forth. So a given tree ring sequence typically has a period when it works and then it stops working. It senesces. It gets old. It gets useless. And in the case of linking that to temperature, it's even trickier. So there's this Siberian forest that has this tree ring data in it that works for a while, and then it diverges from the model. It stops working. So you have to basically X the data out or fix it somehow. And it's a decline in the degree to which it correlates really with other data. So it's just basically a data set that's messy, icky, and they have to fix it. They have to hide it from the other statistics in the model. And it's interesting because this is a very obscure – you could probably take this tree ring data and have never used it to begin with. You could just throw it out. It isn't that – necessary. There's all kinds of other data showing global temperature and increasingly good data, and you don't need to have this, but they were using it and they wanted it to work. And in a private email, the phrase "hide the decline" was used and then matched with another place where they were using Mike's trick as a phrase, which has nothing to do with the tree rings. And it became a sentence that is still out there, and people still say, oh yeah, ClimateGate, that proved that all the climate scientists are lying about everything they've done.
So honestly, this was about as blown out of proportion as you can possibly get.
Yes, and with serious consequences. You know, Michael Mann is under siege. They're the same groups that have who have been doing this all along are now suing to have his private correspondence and emails made available to them to study them, to look for more sentences that they can use. The University of Virginia apparently has a stake in this, and there's a lawsuit. And just recently, Mann went to this court and asked for him to have standing in the suit so that if the court decided, yes, you can see this guy's emails, he actually gets to sit at the table and say how that happens and how that would work. And he won that to the court, so that motion was granted. So he's now involved in it. But this is just some science, climate scientist guy. He doesn't get paid much. There's no organization backing him. People are donating money in $5 and $10 units to serve to get his legal defense paid for. And all he's doing is being harassed. It has a chilling effect on the science in general. If you're a climate scientist and you've got some interesting finding that might enrage denialists, you have to consider the fact that you have to have a lawyer first if your information becomes important in this debate, because they will go after you.
So is there any end in sight to ClimateGate?
Yes, I think there is. I think the current court case that's going on in Virginia, if it's decided in the favor of rational thinking, that will be important. I think that right now there are things, there's some hearings going on in Congress. We're seeing a lot more people who are having a harder time supporting a denialist movement. Yeah, I mean, there are several kinds of denialists out there, and there are the people who have a vested interest in denying global warming. And then there are the people who kind of follow them in a cultish way and get very much involved in this kind of thing as their own private conspiracy theory. And then there's everybody else, who's a majority of deniers, who sort of go along because they're just afraid not to, or because they have some minor interest in it, or they're just thoughtlessly following it. And that latter group will start breaking off when the main vested interest people start to shut up, which they will do shortly for reasons we can talk about in a moment. And that's going to leave just the true believers. And I swear to you, the true believers, I get emails from them every day. They're mostly a bunch of kooks. They could be talking about, I mean, there's all these groups of people out there who have interesting beliefs, like that they were abducted by aliens, or that a tsunami in the Canary Islands is going to destroy the east coast of North America, or that the Yellowstone caldera is going to blow up at any moment, or that global warming is a big lie. And if you listen to what they say and you read their websites, they really are not credible, and they're just the fringe of this sort of movement. And the core of the movement, of the thinking, denialist thinking, are the people who have a vested interest, and they are starting to pull out, with this recent study from Berkeley.
And I do want to talk about the Berkeley study in a moment. But I guess one thing that I'm wondering is, how has this affected those regular people that you talked about, the rest of the people? How has that affected their perception of climate change?
Excellent question. For a long time, there were a lot of those people, and they were only going along with climate change being a hoax because they were Republicans or conservatives, or they just politically were on both sides of the political spectrum, adopt their beliefs that they feel that they're supposed to have, not because they have rationally figured out that this is true. The average liberal progressive thinker who says, yeah, climate change is real, I could probably sit them down and convince them the opposite, because they don't know what they're talking about. They're accountants, or
right.
They're not climate scientists. They don't really know. They're just accepting it. And so are the people who are denying it. You know, most people are just accepting a belief that they're receiving based upon their political orientation. in the recent year or two, because of ClimateGate and other things like that, the number of people in the United States who are denialists or casual denialists has gone from about half of the country to about 70% of the country because of this news media. And over the next few months and so or so, we're hoping that it will reverse because the news media is shifting backwards a little bit with the failure of ClimateGate to really produce anything except on Fox News. And with the BEST study and other things that are happening, I think that's going to shift and we're going to go back to a lower percentage or a lower number. It's still going to be somewhat political, but I think it's going to be less. I think they're going to get the wind knocked out of them, and I think they're going to be less powerful, and they're going to shift more than you ever see, for example, creationists shifting. Those numbers don't change with who is a creationist, but the climate denialism, I think, will change.
So this seems like a good point to talk about the Berkeley Earth Temperature Study. So what is that?
Very briefly, a group of people funded by many groups, including progressive groups and conservative groups, and including the Koch brothers themselves, who more or less own the oil industry, a group run by scientists who were pretty much skeptics themselves about global climate change, took a whole new look at the data, got other data, analyzed it in new ways to sort of see, can we independently say what has happened to Earth temperatures over recent decades? And the answer is that what the climate scientists have been saying all along is absolutely substantiated.
Absolutely.
There's really no wiggle room at all. Absolutely substantiated.
So now why is this a big deal?
It's a big deal because it's essentially denialists, both in terms of who funds it and the political side of it, but also the scientists who are holdouts, taking their best shot at disproving the hypothesis that global climate change is happening, that warming is happening, and that humans have done it, and failing to disprove that hypothesis, the alternative, and basically supporting the current model. It's two big prize fighters going into the ring, and one of them just knocks himself out. It should be the end of the discussion. In any scientific circles, the discussion would have ended a long time ago, but if it hadn't, it would definitely end now. And now politicians who support this denialist position are more likely to be embarrassed and less likely to be supported by other people.
So by any chance, does this mean that once and for all, we're all on the same page?
No, it's not. Once and for all, but what's going to happen is, I mean, there is this sort of 12 to 17% number of people that always think, you know, something very untenable. I mean, that's the number of people who are pretty sure Bigfoot is real, for example.
Right.
Or the number of people who think that they were abducted by aliens is about 12%. About 3% think they are aliens. That kind of works out. So there's always going to be people like that. And for this, it's not going to be even that small of a number. We're going to go down to scary numbers, but not like they are now. Right now, the majority of Americans think climate change is highly questionable. And I think we're going to see over the next year or so the majority of Americans thinking that climate change is real, especially considering – for example, in Minnesota, I mean, we have green grass outside. There are trees that have not lost their leaves. It was 50 degrees today. One day of warm or one season or a weather event does not indicate climate change. But when you have several years in a row in which major changes occur, boats are sailing across the Arctic, that kind of thing, people eventually catch on. And I think what has to happen now is the news media has to get with the program, and they sort of have to now more than ever before. And once they start reporting climate change is real, and now we're just talking about the details rather than it's an unknown or there's a two sides to the story or there's some kind of manufactured balance in their news, once they stop doing that, I think people will kind of follow along.
I love your optimism, sir.
That's how I'm feeling today.
It's a little different. I'll take it. And as always, Greg, lovely to have you here.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
You can find Greg Layden's blog at the link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And while you're there, click the links to Facebook, to Twitter, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show, listen to past episodes, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on! The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell, gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking, our mind reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus pocus, out of focus, locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell, gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced with the support of CJSR 88.5 FM in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Our studio assistants are Brent Kelly and Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician and research assistant. The show is produced and edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by A.O.K. And I'm your host, Desiree Schell.